You're listening to Human Rights 2020s, a podcast from the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. This episode is a recording of a webinar called Our International Human Rights, The Right to Social Security, held in May 2024. In this episode, Consortium Senior Policy Officer Lucy Miller discusses the right to social security with Aidan Flegg, a PhD student from the University of Glasgow. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi everyone, I'm Lucy. I am the Senior Policy Officer here at the Consortium. And I'm delighted to be hosting another one of our lunchtime sessions around our rights with the forthcoming Scottish Government's Human Rights Bill. Basically, this webinar will be shaped around Aidan and I's conversation, so it might go in different directions. And we'll do that for the first 25 to 30 minutes, and then we will have an audience question and answer. So, today, we're talking not just about a general idea of a right to social security, but about an international right that the UK has signed up to and they have agreed to implement. Aidan, before we start, can you please tell me a bit about your role and what the right to social security includes?
Sure. Thanks, Lucy. And thanks for inviting me on to discuss the right to social security. My research is focused on economic, social, cultural rights. I'm based at the University of Glasgow, and I'm in the final year of carrying out my PhD. So I'm actually in the final few months of that write-up. So it's great to be able to come here and discuss these rights in a more kind of practical terms in Scotland. As you discussed, the right to social security exists in international human rights law. It's primarily based in what we call the ICESCR, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights. And this has been ratified by the UK government, which really just in basic means they've agreed to implement the rights and obligations within the treaty. So the ICESCR, it provides the right to social security in Article 9. And what this says is the state's parties to the present covenant recognize the right to everyone to social security, including social insurance. And at its most basic level, this is about ensuring access to levels of social security to secure a life of dignity. So it can be really around kind of relieving poverty, income maintenance and replacements, income redistribution, meeting additional costs such as persons with disabilities or in childcare, and also covering things like compensation and others. So it's quite a broad right. One kind of final important point around just how we read the international right is, yes, it's contained in the ICESCR, and this is where I would kind of draw my main analysis from, but also it's included in other international human rights treaties. So for example, we have Article 26 of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, as well as things like Article 11 and 14 of the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. And these provide slightly different angles and slightly different insights to how the right functions for different groups in society. So we want to kind of look at the framework as a whole to understand what the right to social security is.
Brilliant, thank you. And at that international level, we don't just have a simple right to social security, but these are several elements of the right that are set out, as you've just said. Can you tell us about what that right is in a bit more detail? Like, what does that entitle us to?
Yeah, sure. And this is a really important part of understanding human rights, but also, you know, particularly ESC rights, is that they each have content and that these are things that we're agreeing to implement when we're saying we're meeting the right to social security. So firstly, to break down the right to social security as it's been done through kind of international guidance and commentary, really, we look at it through the lens of what's sometimes called like the AAA framework, but also we can unpack that a little further in understanding it as it's really about the availability of social security schemes. So we want to ensure that benefits are provided and relevant social risks to kind of offset the relevant social risks that exist. So this might be kind of lack of employment or injury or old age or unaffordable access to things like healthcare, which is less in our state, but is very much so in others. So that's really about the availability. Are there social security schemes in place? We're then looking at things like adequacy. So what is the adequacy of that social security scheme? Is it securing that kind of fundamental life of dignity? Is it providing enough for people? this might include like what are the distribution of benefits throughout the society. Another area we would look at is affordability, but that's much more focused on things like insurance schemes. And finally, overall, the accessibility. So this is really focused on not just the fact that the social security scheme is available, but also that it's accessible to people and different groups within society. So this brings in your kind of considerations around non-discrimination, for example. You want to ensure that we're not discriminating in the way that we provide benefits. So really that idea of availability, adequacy, affordability, and accessibility are all really central to how we unpack and understand the rights of social security.
That's really interesting. And I'm going to ask you a question that I didn't prep you for here in our emails beforehand, but how have the Scottish government so far, or how do you think that they plan to make sure that those principles are covered, especially things like accessibility with people's, how they first, you know, reach out to the scheme or apply for it?
So if I understand correctly, are you asking about the kind of actions Scottish government currently takes or the actions it kind of could take to increase accessibility? I mean, accessibility is often, first, it's about ensuring legally that these schemes are in place and are accessible to different groups. But then you're also talking about things like awareness raising. You're talking about ensuring that specific, you know, we know within social security delivery at the moment across the UK, you know, there are many types of benefits that go unclaimed and that there are instances where people should be receiving things but aren't. So these schemes are available, but because they've not been made overly accessible, that could cause potential issues with how we're delivering the right social security. So these are the types of issues that we would want kind of Scottish government to be looking at under this right. Another kind of big area that you might want to look at in terms of the future of how this is delivered is things like digitization of social security systems, so moving that kind of all onto the online sphere. You know, we're already seeing that there are issues with how people that can impact the overall accessibility of social security schemes. So these are the types of areas that I think Scottish Government could be looking at in terms of understanding how to ensure that we create an accessible framework as well as one that's kind of overall available.
That's really helpful. Thanks, Aidan. At our webinar last week, Professor Katie Boyle spoke about the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights and about the key principles that are part of this. In particular, she spoke about the government's need to progressively realise these rights. And there are 8 principles of this progressive realisation. And we can home in on a couple of them today as well. There should be a minimum level of social security available immediately for everyone all of the time. Can you tell us a bit about why that minimum is so important and what that minimum is?
Yeah, sure. And it's a great aspect to focus on, especially in relation to social security. But to do so, I kind of have to wind back a little bit to kind of that broader context of progressive realization, because it only really makes sense to kind of looked at through the lens of the obligations as a total, instead of it kind of being this separate immediate obligation, if you like. So as I'm sure Katie will have covered in the explanation at last seminar, Each right under the ISESCA is understood as requiring progressive realization. And this, in its basic sense, means kind of moving as progressively, as quickly, and as effectively as possible towards the full realization of that right. Now, there is an interpretation of progressive realization, but over time, it's not just about these progressive aspects. It's not just about these future areas that we want to move towards. There's also an immediate baseline that has to be fulfilled. So this is really important because it gives both progressive realization, both this progressive element as well as an immediate element. And we discussed this immediate element as what we call minimum core obligations. And this has really been kind of unpacked through guidance from the Committee on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, as well as through kind of scholarly contributions. So the guidance at the international level really provides kind of mixed bag in relation to what is expected as that minimum core, these immediate aspects of the right that the state has to meet. So to kind of run through some of those that have been given at the international level as guidance, it's really about ensuring access to social security scheme that provides a minimum essential level of benefits to all individuals and families that will enable them to acquire things like essential healthcare, basic shelter and housing, water, sanitation, foodstuffs. So really it's looking at, you know, ensuring that there's a very basic level of social security in place so people are able to access their kind of material needs, if you like. But it goes further and it says, you know, it's also about ensuring that you don't discriminate in terms of delivering those, to respect existing social security schemes and protect them from unreasonable interference. So that unreasonable being really important word in there. Things more procedurally based as well. So we might expect minimum core not just to be about, okay, is there a level of social security payment? It might be how those decisions are being taken. So it might be things like, has the state adopted a transparent social security scheme and kind of overall strategy or plan of action, if you like. And the reason these things are seen as kind of immediately enforceable is that without that baseline, without that kind of starting point, we wouldn't, you know, the right couldn't exist in the first place. And that's the way to kind of think about these minimum core. It's really the absolute baseline of what you would expect for social security to be in place.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I mean, across all rights, minimum core obligations are going to be something that we're all focusing in on as we see this bill and how they develop and are you know, implemented across Scotland. I'm going to ask a question related to that as well. How does the principle of non-discrimination apply to the right to social security here, and what measures should be taken to ensure that everyone has that equal access benefits? I know we've kind of covered that with minimum core, but is there more that could be done?
So non-discrimination is really a cross-cutting principle within the ICESCR itself. So it's actually provided explicitly through Article 2.2. And this basically means it applies as an immediate obligation across every right that's covered by the treaty. And so really we can talk about non-discrimination as this kind of minimum core element across all of the rights. Now, we've already kind of discussed, as you say, you know, some of the efforts that could be made in relation to ensuring that there isn't discrimination, but it's also ensuring kind of that idea of looking at substantive equality as well as. And so it's more complicated in terms of how that actually is practically put into effect, as we're aware. But really it's about ensuring that there's kind of work done, that there's monitoring in place and assessments of how those social security payments are actually reaching those individuals, and ensuring that the current system that we have in place, the current social security schemes we have in place, are not having a kind of discriminatory effect on different areas of society and different persons of society. So there's really a huge amount of efforts that could go into this, which I won't cover, but as a basic principle of non-discrimination, that's kind of what we're looking for. And it's about evidencing that, not just stating it in place.
Another principle of no backsliding on the right as well, which does this mean that the government can never change any of its social security benefits?
Yeah, so this is again another important, what we would call sub duty of progressive realization, and really what we're, you know, I think talking about in terms of that use of backsliding is the principle of what we call non-retrogression. And non-retrogression, as you suggest, is about ensuring that where existing levels of enjoying an ESC right exist, that the government shouldn't unreasonably kind of interfere with that and shouldn't take that away. So a really kind of basic understanding of this might be something like the £20 uplift to universal credit that we saw, and the removal of that, I think, kind of 18 months later or so. And that might be a case where, you know, you would look at that through a right to social security lens and the obligation of non-retrogression to say, well, you've removed that kind of existing level. That isn't to say it would necessarily be a violation. And this is a really important aspect of non-retrogression, is that it's accessible. And it's really about the decision making upon which that regressive measure was taken. The CESCA, the Committee on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, where we kind of draw a lot of our guidance and understanding of this framework, has actually set out a specific test to say, if you've met all these things, then if you've met all these standards, then really you can change social security in a way. You know, government still has to be able to to make decisions based on the evidence that it has. Within that test, you're looking at things like, is there a reasonable justification for what you're doing? You know, have you adequately examined other alternatives? Have we looked at potential other options if you're needing to save money in a tight fiscal space, for example? You know, was there genuinely participation of affected groups within? It could also be things like the measures were they discriminatory, as we discussed already. That's kind of minimum core area. So if it's discriminatory, that would still, you know, that would fall foul of the regressive test. And finally, you cannot impact upon this minimum core. So that's why this minimum core again takes up real importance within the overall framework, because you cannot kind of backslide from a minimum core position because it is that absolute baseline. So sorry, that's quite a long-winded way of answering the question, but it's the principle of non-rate regression is there to ensure that anytime a backsliding does take place, there is that kind of reasonable justification and evidence base from the government to say why that's necessary.
No, that's really good to know, and I'm sure we've got a few snippets from that that we can definitely use on social media in coming months for a really easy explanation of that. So the Scottish Government plan to introduce a human rights bill that incorporates ISESCR, so that's economic, social and cultural rights, into law here in Scotland, and will make these ISESCR rights enforceable by individuals and communities. This means that we will have an enforceable right to social security. Am I right in thinking that? And then why is that important? And what does enforceability mean, I guess, as well in that context?
Yeah, sure. So this is more complicated than it feels on the surface. And I think, again, you know, my colleague Katie will have covered this in a bit more detail in last week's seminar. So I'm going to touch upon some of the kind of critical elements of this, but I'm not going to dive into the kind of constitutional details involved in reserve powers, as I think that's been covered in last week's. But certainly in terms of the kind of wider approach and reason for going through the incorporation process, if you like, is that currently the right to social security is not directly what we call justiciable and enforceable in Scotland. And we really understand this as an accountability gap. So where things like the Human Rights Act have provided you with enforceable rights, if you like, things like freedom of expression or right to a fair trial, that is not equated across to your economic, social, cultural rights. Now, Scotland has recognized in the Social Security Act of 2018 the place of social security as a human right, but that legislation didn't actually incorporate that into an enforceable, justiciable right within. So the incorporation process, if you like, is really focused on closing that accountability gap, and so far as it's possible to do within our devolved powers, ensuring that this right is accessed through the courts and through other forms of complaint mechanisms. Like. So that's really what we mean by making the right enforceable. And kind of have that centre of legality and accountability at its centre.
Thanks for that. So, Aidan, there are big calls on the government to improve our social security system as a key part of tackling poverty. Things like calls from many of our members at the consortium on the Scottish Government to raise the Scottish child payment, to the UK government to end the two-child limit and to increase things like universal credit and to end any sanctions that are faced within the system and more. If our right to social security was enforceable and embedded into law, would it make any difference to policy decisions such as these?
It's a great question and really great areas to kind of be pushing on as well. So that's fantastic. But I think here it's important to focus on kind of two different understandings of how we implement and how we give effect to rights. So on the one hand, we have that legal implementation, if you like, that legal incorporation into Scots law. And this, as discussed, is really about that accountability process and ensuring the government can be held to account in the same way that it might be for other human rights. And so that in and of itself should directly impact upon the way in which Scottish government is making its decisions around social security, that inevitable accountability that is brought in. However, as I'm sure many of us or some of us are aware, the devolved settlement and the fact that much of Social Security remains as a reserved area to UK government and is obviously delivered through things like universal credit. You know, there's recognition of the limits of the legal powers of Scottish government to take action in this space. And so really that kind of brings me on to the second area here, which is also about not just focusing on the legal incorporation and, you know, this idea of enforcing them to do something. This is about international law as well. And you know, the fact that we've already agreed to these standards, we've already ratified and said that we're going to implement, and Scotland has the powers to observe and implement these international obligations within the devolved context. So what we're looking at is ensuring that this framework, this rights-based approach, if you like, to understanding social security in Scotland becomes embedded throughout those decision-making processes, becomes embedded throughout how the schemes are delivered and ensuring that there's kind of participation, that there's transparency within those decision-making processes and others. Yes, accountability will help through enforcement, but other implementation measures are going to be equally as effective at kind of pressurizing the Scottish government to look at some of these decisions again.
One of those that I can see is probably the role of civil society. And obviously we've got a few representatives from civil society on the call today. What role do civil society and charity organisations play in advocating for and ensuring the implementation of the right to social security? What can we do to keep pressure up?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, and I'm quite sure there are many people on this call who would happily jump in here to say all the many things that they're doing and could be doing more. So, but yeah, you know, human rights are the responsibility of duty bearers primarily, but they are also kind of that wider culture change point. And I think that this idea of civil society, you know, there's a huge role for all these bodies, duty bearers as well as non, to ensure that these kind of rights are being filtered through our decision-making processes, that they're raised at different levels of governance as well. You know, this is not just about Scottish government, this is also about kind of how it delivers and impacts throughout different areas of society. But also I think adopting the language of human rights and economic, social, cultural rights can be a really powerful and effective tool at demonstrating that these are not kind of nice to haves, that these are international legal agreements that we've ratified and that we're yet to kind of meaningfully put into effect. And I think that these are really strong ways of kind of engaging in some of these issues and making sure that you're keeping up that pressure, if you like, to have an adequate social security system.
And we've got a pre-submitted question actually, which relates to that, but it is how public awareness and understanding of the right to social security could be improved to foster greater support. Like, how do we get that information out to people? Time and time again in the consortium, we do workshops and sessions where people tell us it's just there's such a lack of information on finding out about what your human rights are and how to access them. So how could we improve that specifically, I guess, for the right to social security? But I guess you may answer this generally about human rights information anyway.
Yeah, you know, of course, kind of filtering these information and particularly international human rights law, you know, it's not the most accessible language and accessible framework for people to kind of research in themselves and kind of go online and start reading about. You know, it's kind of cloaked in a lot of different approaches and languages and other stuff. So it's such an important aspect you pick up on is how to make this framework and how to make these rights really accessible to everyone who's working through these organizations, as well as duty bearers, you know, and that's going to be a critical aspect of the overall kind of implementation of the bill and ensuring that these rights are not kind of opaque, but are really understood throughout the different sectors of society. You know, I think there's a lot of different aspects that we could do. You know, the work Katie and I did on those briefings in Nuffield, that's one very simple way of us, you know, as academics, kind of producing slightly more accessible documents that can be shared with practitioners and those working throughout different organizations to kind of give you a basic of the overall legal landscape and how you can adopt some of these approaches. But also, I think having that kind of wider discussion on current social security in Scotland, you know, it's human rights is one lens which to view it, and it can also learn from other institutional approaches that are already in existence. So I think that deliberation around how we want to best implement the right to social security will really begin to kind of build those bridges, if you like, between someone who might look at it from a rights-based perspective and someone who might look at it as a kind of anti-poverty perspective.
Yeah. So it's just so interesting. Can you please give any examples of how different countries have maybe successfully implemented the right to social security? I understand that might not be your area at all, so if you don't have an answer, that's totally fine. But you may do.
Sure. So yeah, this is really looking at where this right has been incorporated. And this comes down to really different models of incorporation, if you like. And so it may not be that in constitutions around the world where people's human rights are often placed and provided for. This might be looking at not specific wording around the right to social security, although certain states have done this successfully, places like South Africa, for example. Right, social security appears in the constitution, enforceable, and there are cases with the courts in relation to that. But actually, one really great case that kind of highlights both the minimum core element of this and is focused on social security levels is provided for through the German Constitutional Court. And while it's not directly focused on the right to social security as it appears in the treaty text, it is about this idea of minimum core and about securing a life of dignity. And so within what's called the Hartz-IV course, case, sorry, it went through the German Constitutional Court, is what we find is that due to recent changes the German government had placed on social security payments and the scheme that existed there, the court was asked to firstly assess those levels, but also the kind of procedure and decision making that went behind those. And so while it wasn't the court's place to say that the kind of levels of social security being given, those payments being made, it did focus on issues like the procedures behind it and the decision making of how they've reached to the fact that this level of social security payment in Germany that was being seen as kind of not being able to provide those material needs like access to food or healthcare or adequate housing, for example. And it really demonstrated that the decision-making process had insufficient evidence, it wasn't transparently made. You know, it was kind of saying you've come up with this random number of what social security should be without demonstrating why that's the case. And this could really be understood as, while not kind of directly on the right to social security, it shows how this idea of kind of minimum baseline should be taken into account. And this is how, you know, directly on a case that was brought around the insufficiency of social security payments in Germany to kind of vulnerable groups, if you like. So yeah, it's been successfully enforced in other countries around the world. You know, this is not brand new. It's very much a new conversation in the UK. But there's huge amounts of practice and information and awareness and learning we can do from other states.
Brilliant. I always think it is best to learn from others actually and see how we can best do it ourselves. My final question is, what mechanisms are in place to hold governments accountable if they fail to meet those obligations, if they fail to meet that minimum core under the right to social security? What are the levers we can use, let's say, if they're not met with this human rights bill?
Sure. So again, this is more complex because of the devolved and reserved powers that exist, especially after the UNCRC judgment, where it kind of closed off, well, provided a different interpretation, shall we say, and this kind of unqualified power of the UK government. So really, this is a more complex question than probably I want to go into in detail at this moment. But really, what we're looking at is kind of complaints. So that might be your legal route, if you like. So a part of the duties around social security is to ensure access to an effective remedy. And so if the duty bearer has failed to meet the standards of the right, then really what we'd be looking at is challenging those decisions and challenging under the right to social security, saying, well, you've not met those standards, so that we might go look at a kind of court process to hold the government accountable. Now, these are much more limited because of specific circumstances. So But it's also important to understand court as a really a kind of means of last resort. You know, it's really not a very accessible means of accountability. So with the rights brought into Scots law and brought into incorporated into our system, we will be able to see that actually other efforts and other means will become available, like your average complaints mechanisms. You know, your might be through a local authority, might be through a specific institution, might be through an ombudsman. It might, you know, but we have numerous non-judicial routes to provide remedies within the state. And I think that it's important to think about when you're talking about accountability, not just immediately jump into the idea that there's going to be a court case, but also looking at these non-judicial remedies and non-judicial routes, if you like, that are going to be equally important to ensuring accountability.
Thanks for that. Again, really interesting. We do have a question here now from Ross. So they ask, when we consider non-discrimination under Article 14 ECHR, there is a well-developed body of case law that informs our approach, especially in the area of social security. Do you think we will be taking a similar approach to non-discrimination challenges under the bill / the UN treaties, or is there distinct jurisprudence that we will have to familiarise ourselves with? Again, not an easy question.
No, and you know, I'll provide the best answer I can. You know, it's not the kind of jurisprudence that currently exists under Article 14 ECHR is not my particular area of expertise. And nor do I know what the final bill looks like. So it's very difficult to kind of make an assessment and on how those duties are going to interact and how the Equality Clause or other such is going to interact with that. There's also the added aspect here that there's discrimination is a particularly complex aspect of the Scotland the Scottish Revolution Agreement with the Equal Opportunities Reservation. And so this is a really challenging area, I think, for the bill probably, but in general, kind of foreseeing exactly how non-discrimination is going to work as that principle within a domestic legal framework, if you like. But certainly, my thoughts would be that they would be looking, seeking to take an approach which is more in line with economic, social, cultural. Actually, we have specific guidance on what non-discrimination means within those within these specific rights and how they attach to those. And that guidance was developed quite later than the language of Article 14 of the ECHR. And so it provides a kind of much wider concept of what we might mean by discriminatory practices and what we might mean by things like substantive equality and other such. So my hope would be that the development of the bill has taken into account this specific interpretation of non-discrimination in relation to ESC rights, instead of focusing on purely on the kind of non-discrimination framework that currently exists. But as I say, that's a complicated kind of legal question.
Thanks very much for that. Thanks very much, everyone, for coming. These lunchtime sessions have been hugely helpful for myself anyway. And I hope to see you all at the next one. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Human Rights 2020s podcast. For more information about our work as Scotland's civil society network for the protection and promotion of human rights, please visit our website at www.hrcscotland.org or follow us on Twitter at @hrcscotland. Thank you.